Florida, Ray.
My name is Ray O'Keefe. I'm an alcoholic. I have an announcement here from the hotel. In case of fire, with all the Al-Anons, please remain seated. Until the alcoholics are well clear of the building. I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous a long time. You can tell by looking at me, I've been somewhere for a long time. Let me tell you about my drinking. You don't want to miss any of this. This is a thrill a minute. I was born in one of the neighborhoods in New York City. And my neighborhood was rough, and it was tough, and it was Irish. It'll be a great surprise for you to learn that they drank in that neighborhood. You would actually see people on the street under the influence of alcohol. And if you look where I lived, you see a little drinking. My mother, the widow O'Keefe, was known to take a drink from time to time. When the pressure got on, Kitty would go for the light wines and the spirits, and something would fly, usually one of the children. My brother Billy, on the other hand, was a very bad drinker, and in a neighborhood of Irish drunks, Billy O'Keefe stood out. So when I showed up at the local place and ordered up whatever it was they were serving 14-year-olds that afternoon, no one paid any attention to me. It was just another O'Keefe coming through the system. I don't really recall what they gave me that day. I suspect it was a beer. That was a neighborhood drink. But whatever it was, I liked it. I liked everything about it. I liked the way it looked. And I liked the way it smelled. And I like the way it tastes. And I like what it did for my head. And I like the noise and the smoke and the confusion. And I like the fist fights and the Irish music. I like the bullshit. That's what it was really was. I was going through the parochial school system, in a manner of speaking. And I got into all of this trouble you might imagine a young man would get into trying to go through that system drunk. I was thrown out of high school a number of times. I held the neighborhood record for being thrown out of high school, a record previously established by my brother Billy. When I was finished with high school, or more properly put, when they were finished with me, because someone made a mistake somewhere, I ended up in a college. And it was way up in another state. And they had no bars in that state. You just had restaurants. And these people sat around at tables, and they drank beer out of bottles. And they sang college songs. And they wore white shoes in the wintertime. And being a man of no particular moral fiber, I got a pair of white shoes. I learned the words to some of those songs. I got very collegiate. World War II was just about over. It was relatively safe. So one day I got a haircut and joined the Navy. And I ended up right here on a ship in the bay. And I went on my first liberty in the city of San Francisco, and I got all the beer in me I could buy. I hate to be indelicate when I speak, but I have to tell you, I had a lot of trouble with my kidneys when I drank. And in the Navy, we slept three to a tier. Don't get ahead of me now. This is not easy. I came back from that Liberty with all the beer in me I could buy, and I went to sleep. I had one of these attacks. And I met the fellow that slept below me that night. He thought he'd be wet sometime during his naval career. It just hadn't occurred to him it would happen while he was sleeping. The rest of my naval career was just as distinguished. And I got back to the neighborhood some years later, and everything was under control in the neighborhood. The widow was out in the weeds somewhere. My brother Billy was missing from the New York City Police Department. Billy had invited a citizen off the five-story roof, and the citizen had bounced and lived to identify the Irish cop. So Billy went back in the Marine Corps. It was a more peaceful line of work. The government was sending veterans $20 a week for 52 weeks. I qualified for some checks. I gravitated to the local saloon. I took up the game of shuffleboard. And I was planning a life of petty crime with some of my boyhood companions when I had one of those clear thoughts to come. I remembered that I'd been to college. So I got on a bus and I went back up there, and I arrived in the middle of a blizzard, and there they were sitting around the table, drinking beer out of a bottle, singing no songs, wearing no shoes. So I got another pair of shoes. And now a grateful government was sending me a check every month, so I was relatively solvent and moderately drunk all the time. One day I was staggering around the campus in my usual condition, and I saw a list of names on a bulletin board of people who were qualified to graduate, and my name was on the list. And that was excellent news. I thought I had another year to go. I notified the widow of this great event, and she came north, and that was a very tender sight. The widow and her youngest child staggering around under the elms. Years later, I served as a trustee of that college, and I go to meetings, and they were still talking about my mother. It's not often in the state of Vermont where they see a little old lady get off a train at 9 o'clock in the morning drunk. I got back to the neighborhood after college, and the question was what to do. My uncles, who ran the family, had voted unanimously that I become a New York City policeman. Of course, that's what my father had done, and that's what my brother had done, and that's what all my uncles and cousins were doing, except for the two morons that worked for the telephone company. But I told them I had my own plans, and I had a scholarship to law school. So I went off to law school. I didn't know anything about law school. We didn't have any lawyers in my neighborhood. We had cops and we had priests. We really didn't need any lawyers. And I went on the wagon for law school. I stopped drinking, and as a result of that, I came out of law school, and I had done well, and I was taken into a large, white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, Wall Street law firm. They hired me as sort of the resident immigrant. It was not a total loss, however. I did learn to say, oh, really, instead of no shit. No, really? My superiors there determined that I should be trained as a trial lawyer. And so I was sent up to the courthouse in New York City to learn my trade. And I wasn't in the courthouse too long when I discovered that all the really smart guys had moved into the saloon across the street. So I moved my office into the saloon. And I learned to drink in a civilized way, very genteel. Very few members of the profession were knocking down shots and beers where anybody could see them. I discovered scotch in a tall glass with water and ice, and you sip on that, It takes a little while, but it gets the job done. I was introduced to all of the mysteries and all of the rituals that surround the very, very dry martini. And to this evening and to this minute, my love, my admiration, and my affection for the very, very dry martini is surely the greatest case of unrequited love the world has ever seen. I was so loyal to those things, and they almost destroyed me. After about a year of this civilizing process, it was necessary in my natural development that I be married, and I had located a lady, or she had located me. Who knows how that works? Mrs. O'Keefe, my wife, my current wife, I always call her my current wife. I find it keeps her on her toes. Mrs. O'Keefe was from a totally different background than mine, and she was raised with a very nice family and a very nice home with a fence and a dog. And I will not burden you with the details of my wedding day. But I assure you that when the O'Keefes from the South Bronx hit the Westchester Country Club, they set a few records. There was only one fight, not a particularly good fight. My Uncle Bernie hit a waiter. After that, we set up housekeeping. Mrs. O'Keefe began to deliver children in a rather boring and monotonous way, and with the regularity that is known only to the Roman Catholic. And shortly after one of those events, I received a phone call from the dean of the law school I had attended, and he invited me to school, and I went to see the dean, and he appointed me to the faculty, and I became Professor O'Keefe. And I responded to that appointment with great alacrity, and there I was, the boy professor. And I knew that I drank a great deal, so I resolved that I would drink less. And I entered into a period of controlled drinking, and I was very unsuccessful at that. I was then 26 years of age when I thought I'd have to control my drinking. But as I went on teaching, after a few years of teaching, I discovered that I was competent to teach, and therefore there was no reason not to drink. So I went back out to drink the way I wanted to drink. And I only knew the one way to drink. My father died when I was 2, and my brother Billy was 4 years older. And Billy was not at all like me. He was tall and good-looking and athletic and all of that. And Billy was my big brother and was my father, and Billy was my hero, and I tried to do everything just like Billy. And I drank just like Billy. I drank until I fell down, or the place went on fire, or the cops arrived, or something happened. So I went out and started to do that again, and I roamed around the city of New York doing all those things that you do when you roam around the city of New York. And because I was on this law school faculty of the Fordham University School of Law, I was appointed to all kinds of commissions and committees by the mayor and the governor and all of that. And in the meantime, Ms. O'Keefe and I had acquired a very nice home, and we had it up to about 6 or 7 kids, the average number for an Irish family, and the usual motor vehicles and the usual memberships and the usual obscure clubs. And I was teaching and working, and I was in politics for a while, and even ran for office one time and lost. And had you asked me in those days how I was doing, I would have told you I was doing very well. As a matter of fact, I would have told you I was doing very well whether you asked me or not. Truth of the matter was, at this time, at age 34, I had turned into a daily drunk. And my day would have killed a lesser man. I used to wake up in the morning in that wet bed because the problem with the kidneys had continued unabated all those years. And I would struggle out of that wet sack, and I begin my morning aerobics My aerobics were performed kneeling on the floor of a bathroom with my head in a bowl. And I had all the water running, the water in the shower and the water in the tub and the water in the sink, because I did not want Mrs. O'Keefe and all those little O'Keefes to know that Professor O'Keefe was dying. I would come downstairs with carrying over my shoulder, much like Santa Claus, a sack of wet laundry, because Mrs. O'Keefe told me that the diaper service was for the children. And she did not think that a lady of her extreme breeding ought to do the wash of a 34-year-old bedwetter. If you can imagine a man of my stature in the community starting off each morning with a load of wash. But once I got my wash out of the way, help was at hand. I had a quart of vodka in the refrigerator. My children call that daddy's juice. And I take a few bangs on daddy's juice, and then the question was, would I throw up in front of all these people? I knew if I lit up a cigarette, it was all over. Sooner or later, I get into New York City and to Grand Central. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Grand Central. Grand Central is really not a railroad station. It is a collection of saloons that are connected by tunnels. So I would tear around the tunnels and pop up here or there. And then I would go to the school, and as soon as I got onto that imposing institution, my first thought was, how do I get out of here? And I'd get out, and I'd tear across town. I'd steal money from a petty cash fund, and then I'd be in business for the rest of the day. And I'd go to the saloon down by the courthouse, my original parish, and I'd buy a drink, and they'd buy a drink, and the bartender would buy a drink, and we'd all buy a drink, and it was marvelous. And I had it figured out in some peculiar alcoholic way that I was particularly brilliant at 2 o'clock. So I'd schedule all my classes for that, and I'd go up and shortchange those poor, unwilling sophisticates who had come to study law at my feet. And then I'd be out of there, and I'd go over to Grand Central to commute. Now, even though I grew up in the Bronx, I understood the theory of commuting. Commuters are entitled to a drink before they get on the train. So I'd have 10 or 12. And I would take a train north. It didn't have to go where I lived. North was good enough for me. And I'd arrive home sometime or other and bounce off a few walls and take what was left of daddy's juice out of the refrigerator and fill up an old cheese glass that some kid had left laying around and inquire if anybody wanted a martini. But I was the only one that drank in that house in those days, and evenings I would spend in civic endeavor. Lawyers are very fond of civic endeavor. Civic endeavor by me was cracking up the car or puking on some hostess's sofa or playing a little grab-ass with the ladies of Larchmont and a sorrier-looking crop you have never seen. Most nights I would just stay home and vegetate, and I'd watch television with one eye like this, trying to get those sets to come together. And I'd watch television with the one eye, and I would drink, and I would go through the programming and through the news and on into the evening shows. And finally, my big moment would come when they played the national anthem. And the Marines would go up Mount Suribachi. And those destroyers would be coming through the water. And they'd be playing that song. And I would cry. Oh, I would weep and sob and cry. And then I'd go upstairs and wet the bed. And that's it. Another wonderful day. Now, this is not once in a while. This is every day. Weekends, I would say, for binges. And if everybody around me would mind their own business, which was extremely rare, I could get drunk 3 times on Saturday and 3 times on Sunday. Well, as anybody who's ever been married can tell you, While all of this was going on, Mrs. O'Keefe was not entirely silent. From time to time, she would have the temerity to suggest that there was something radically wrong with the way I drank. But I would pay no attention to her. Why should I? First of all, she is my wife. How much can she know? Secondly, she is not an attorney. And because she is fairly dim, I used to explain to her the relativity of drinking, which is to say that some people drink more than other people. And on a relative scale, I would explain to her I was not a very big drinker. As a matter of fact, I would say, I don't drink as much as my mother. And she would say, nobody drinks as much as... Well, and then she had offended my mother, and I would have to leave. I go over and visit Mom. While all of this drove her nuts, and she betook herself to her physician, who, as you might imagine, was an obstetrician, and he could discover nothing the matter with her until she told him that she lived with a drunk. So he sent her back to me with a message, and the message she brought me was that her doctor, the obstetrician, had diagnosed her husband, the professor of law, as an alcoholic. I was very upset. I rose to defend myself, as was my custom, and I launched into one of my tirades, and I made the first point was that I took a very dim view of a physician who would diagnose a patient without having seen the patient. I was against that shabby type of medical practice all too common in our country today. I then went into high gear and I asked Mrs. O'Keefe a question to which she has not yet discovered the answer. I asked her what kind of a man became an obstetrician in the first place. And at this point, the conversation was coming downhill, and then it happened. I don't know how this happened. I cannot explain to you how this happened. I can explain many, many other things to you, and I probably will in the second or third hour of this terrific talk I am giving her. But in the middle of all of this yelling and confusion, I stopped, and I admitted to Mrs. O'Keefe, for the first time I'd ever admitted to anyone, that there was at least the possibility that I drank too much sometimes. This was a very serious tactical error. 3 days later, I was in a mental institution in Stamford, Connecticut. And I was only there a matter of moments when I discovered a very serious architectural deficiency in the building. There was no doorknob on my side of the door. I was overcome with great feelings of outrage because, in addition to everything else that was going on, it happened to be the occasion of my 35th birthday. And I mentioned this to a man in a white coat who was passing by, and I very carefully explained to this cretin that on that very day I had attained age 35. And therefore, under the Constitution of the United States of America, I was eligible for the office of president. He urged me not to plan any campaigns. He said there were two other presidents in residence. And then he went away and left me. So for the next week or so, I did all of those wonderful, warm, happy, and interesting things that alcoholics do when they withdraw from alcohol. I saw things, I heard things, I shook, I sweat. I did everything pleasant you can think about, and I finally came up for air. And I was then visited by the staff of the hospital who were psychiatrists, and this was a very fancy rattlebox, as befitted a man of my stature. And I gave three completely different stories to three psychiatrists, and they told me I was in grave danger of being expelled from a mental institution. Jesus. They told me I was not cooperating. And I was cooperating. I was playing Monopoly with three guys who were there. They were an alcoholic. They were just there. And we played a lot of Monopoly, and one of them was under the impression that I was his real estate broker. And if you know anything about the game of Monopoly and some nut thinks you're his real estate broker, you can do very, very well. And I had the boardwalk. I had several hotels in trust. I was very happy with the Monopoly therapy. And they came in one day and said I had a visitor, and I didn't know what that was, so I went into my large executive-type padded cell. And I waited for the visitor, and through the door of that room came this very imposing man. And he said he was from the Darien, Connecticut group of Alcoholics Anonymous, that the hospital had given up on me, and they wanted him to talk to me of our program. I immediately reverted to my origins in the Bronx because I almost had the son of a bitch by the throat. Said, what are you, out of your mind? And he told me to shut up. I immediately forgave him because I knew that they had neglected to tell him who I was. So I began to tell him who I was. He told me to sit down and to shut up and to listen to him. Well, he was an imposing-looking man, and I was not a well person. So for the first time in my life, I sat and he began to explain to me, as we are instructed in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, what his life had been like, how he had come to this program, and what life had been for him since. And he asked me if I would like to go with him to a meeting. And I said, do you mean outside to a meeting, sir? He said, outside. I said, I'll go. Besides that, he gave me matches. And that's how it began with me, and that was in January of 1963. And he made arrangements for me to go when I got out. I got out, and I began to go locally. And I don't remember so much about all of that. I was too new and too nervous and too afraid and too everything. And the hospital had turned me loose with a large jar of those pills they used to insist on giving alcoholics. I was eating that stuff, and so my head buzzed a lot. But I understood myself fairly well. I figured I would come to Alcoholics Anonymous. You would elect me your president. I was always president if I joined something. And I would serve a term as your president, and that would be that. Well, as you can expect, it didn't work out that way. And I found out 10 months later that I was drunk again. I lasted 10 months and I was drunk again. And this time, of course, I was drunk with a great difference, because I had turned away from the great power in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was to stay drunk for a period of time, and I won't bring you through that because it takes too long and it still gives me the willies when I think about it. But just let me indicate to you that this was, without question, the worst period of my life. It was murder. It was pure and simple murder. I would drink a week, then I wouldn't drink a month. I would drink a month, then I wouldn't drink a week. I would drink and come to these meetings. I would come to these meetings and then I would drink. I never knew what was going to happen or when I'd be drinking or when I wouldn't be drinking. And things began to happen to me that had never happened to me before. And I do not speak to you now of things that happened to me in this period of time, which I no longer consider to be important. I do not speak to you of the fact that I was dismissed from the faculty and fired as a tenured professor of law. I do not speak to you of the fact that I was in trouble, and I mean serious personal, professional, and financial problems. I do not even speak to you of the fact that I had lost the care and the affection of all those who were around me. All of this happened to me in this period of time, but that is not what I'm speaking to you about. What I now understand was happening to me at that time was that there was in my case, and perhaps in yours, a terrible, terrible disintegration of my spirit. My spirit, the thing that separates me from my cat and separates me even from each of you. The spirit which gives to this particular form whatever individuality or personality or character that it might have. And this was a spirit which once burned in me so bright, and it was extinguished, and I knew it, and there was nothing I could do about it. I had been here, and this didn't work for me. And by this time, I've been through everything else. I've been through the sanitariums and the doctors and the nurses, and I've been through the politicians and the jobs and the money, and the answer was always the same. I was drunk. And it wasn't as though I didn't know about alcoholism. I knew about alcoholism. I had a memory. I remembered the neighborhood. I knew about my family. I had been to the funerals. I knew what alcoholism was, but as the book tells us, self-knowledge doesn't do anything for us. And I drank, and I drank. And truly, truly, as I stand before you, I really did not think that I could ever stop drinking. But my day came one day. One day, my day came. I don't know any more about this than you do, but it seems to me that there is a time for all of us. And it seems to me that there is a time for each of us. I say to you that there is a line somewhere beyond which we cannot proceed. And I say to you that there is a point somewhere below which we are not allowed to sink. And I say to you that there is a level of pain somewhere beyond which no human is required to endure. I don't know where this line is for you. I only know what happened to me. And this is a personal and an individual thing. And I am convinced that it is different in each case. And for some, it may be death. And that's the way it was for my brother Billy. They call one night from the Veterans Hospital in Minneapolis. The man said my brother was dead of alcoholism and that he had collapsed in the skid row of Minneapolis and had been taken to the VA hospital. And so my brother and my hero died the way alcoholics oftentimes do, without friends, without family. And he was a long, long way from our neighborhood. But my brother Billy doesn't drink anymore. And that's what happened to him. And for other people, it can be something trivial. But that line is there, somewhere. And we all come to it in our own time and in our own way, but come to it we must. And I arrived at a day that really wasn't so different from thousands of other days. I was in this place where I worked. I hadn't had a drink for a couple of days. I was nervous. I was thirsty. And the option I had was to go downstairs. There was a bar in the building, or to call a longtime friend of mine who is a longtime member of this program. And he is my sponsor, and his name is John. And I called John. And I told him what was going on with me, and he said he'd be right over, and he did come over. And John walked into that room, and he looked so good. And I felt so bad. And I said to him, how can I be as successful as you are in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous? And John gave me that look that he has, and he said, don't drink. Go to meetings. You'll be all right. Well, I didn't want him to tell me that. And I told him that I didn't want him to tell me that. I said, John, you don't even understand the problem. The problem is I should not be working in this place. I'm too good a lawyer for this place. Well, he said, don't drink and go to meetings and maybe you'll do better. I said, John, at home it's worse. I cannot go up there anymore. He said, well, if you don't drink and you go to meetings, it might improve. He said, I'm being sued by a bank for money. He said, oh, yes, I heard about that. Well, if you don't drink and you go to the meetings. I began to sense that there was no dialogue there. I have never been able to be as good a sponsor as my sponsor. He was something. He really was. I would say things like, I don't feel good. He'd say, well, this may be as good as you're ever going to feel. Or I would say things like, when am I going to get a good job? And he said, you had one. And then I say to him, I'm very, very nervous. What should I do? He said, hang on. I said, well, how do you hang on? He said, let go. He was black belt AA, I'll tell you. And that day he said, come on, you're not doing anything. And he took me by the hand and he sucked me on that train up to Lodge Barn. It's about a 40-minute ride. halfway up, I reconsidered. You understand? The hell did I call him for? I must have panicked. Don't drink, right? Don't drink my ass. Wait till this train stops. And that was my attitude, and I got off the train, and standing on the platform of the station was my mailman, a guy named Al, who was then chairman of the local group. And Al said, "Get in the car." And I said, "Get out of here, Al. I don't hang around with mailmen." Al said, "Get in the car." So I got in Al's car. I said, "I got a lot of problems here, Al." He said, "Well, just don't drink and you go to the meetings, you might be all right." And Al took me up to the group that night. And I didn't drink that day. And I haven't had a drink since. And that was... You're supposed to let me tell you when, for Christ's sake. And that was November 24th, 1965.
All
right. Yeah, right. Well, I'll tell you this. First, I had that day. And I had that day because two members of this fellowship were so grateful for what this fellowship had done for them that they took what God sent that day, a drunken, dishonest, arrogant man, and because they were so very grateful for what they had received, they gave me a day. They made me the present of a day. And because of that day, I am convinced all of the other days have gone on. And they had me going to meetings, and John said, "Listen, based on your obvious intelligence, your educational background, we think that 7 meetings a week ought to do it for you." I didn't let him push me around. I went to 9. And that's where I go to now. I go to 9 meetings a week. I'm not telling you what to do. I'm telling you what I do. I go to 9 meetings a week. I don't think that I should stay sober any differently than I got sober. Why the hell should I stop going? Besides, I like AA meetings. And after 3 or 4 months, John gave me one of his reviews. And he fixed me with a glance, and he said, "The trouble with you, O'Keefe, is that you are ignorant." By this time, I had gotten to know him. And I said, "Please, sir, tell me in what respect you find me ignorant so that I may hasten to correct the situation." He said, "You are ignorant because you think Alcoholics Anonymous is to stop you from drinking." I said, "I was under that impression, yes, yes." He said, "Drinking has nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. And until and unless you read the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, you will never know what this program is about." And I said, "I have read the book, Alcoholics Anonymous." And he gave me that horrible, horrible look that he has. And he said, "Read it again." And I said, "Yes, John," because I knew that no conversation with this man was ever over until I said, "Yes, John." So I began again to read the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. He was right. I was ignorant. I had no idea that book had been written some 5 years after Bill met Bob, that in the course of the 5 years, 100 or so men and women had recovered from a seemingly hopeless condition of mind and body, and to tell us precisely how they recovered, they wrote this book. had no idea that the steps that are contained in the fifth chapter of that book were steps actually taken by these men and women as they progressed, and that the book is nothing more or less than a chronicle of the early members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought when first I came here, if I told you my name was Ray O'Keefe and that I was an alcoholic, I was doing something about the first step. Well, that's my name, and I'm an alcoholic. But the men and women who founded this program did a great deal more than simply identify themselves as alcoholics. They admitted that they were powerless over alcohol, that their lives had become unmanageable, and their lives were unmanageable because they were powerless over alcohol. It was all the same thing with them. It was all one thing. They were powerless. They had no power. The book tells us that the dilemma of the alcoholic is his lack of power. They are without power. They are powerless. But they didn't drink. And time began to pass for them. And time has passed for me and for this great convention. And if you are new, my brother, time will pass for you. Time has a very nice way of passing in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It passes one day at a time. And somewhere after this succession of days, these men and these women came to believe that there was a power greater than their own. They believed that this power could restore them to sanity. And this was not just a casual reference that they made. They believed this. It was part of them. And as they believe, I believe. And so true was that belief that they made a decision to turn their wills and their lives over to the care of this power that they had come to believe in, this God as they each understood him. And they were very, very bright, because at a time in the history of our country, when no one else had this idea, they conceived alcoholism as a disease. They conceived it as a disease that was physical and mental and spiritual. A disease of the body and of the mind and of the spirit. And when they stopped drinking, their bodies responded quickly. And when they saw what was going on around them, when they came to believe, they enjoyed a mental recovery. And when they made that decision, when they made that decision, that was the key that opened the door. And they let down the basis not only for a spiritual recovery, but for a spiritual way of life to which you and I are heir. They left that to us. And they knew that it was not enough to simply stop drinking and start praying. It doesn't work. They knew that if they were to be successful, somehow they would have to change. And in order to effect this change in themselves, they began a searching and a fearless moral inventory of themselves. They sought to determine the exact nature of their wrongs. And so great was the love and the affection of these people, one for the other, that they were able to admit this inventory to themselves and to the God of their understanding and to each other. And it was a very great relief for me to be able to go through this process with John. It was he who made clear to me the exact nature of my wrongs. And then they developed an attitude which came hard for me. They became entirely ready to have God remove all their defects of character. And with compelling logic, they went to this great power that they had come to believe. And they humbly asked that power to take from them everything, the good and the bad, which stood in the way of their being useful to him and to their fellows. And the program worked for them. And no matter what else is ever said or thought or written about this program, the one thing upon them which there must be perfect unanimity is that it works. It really does. And if anyone ever had any doubt that it works, all you would have to do was to bring them into this room at this minute and tell them to look around. The program never fails. And we don't need any help from anybody else to tell us that. The program never fails. They knew that they had not come here alone. They knew that in their lives, as in mine, there was wreckage and baggage. And so they resolved and wrote a list of everyone they had ever harmed. And they made amends to everyone on their list. And by this time, they said they had been restored to sanity, and they had ceased fighting anyone or anything. And they didn't just talk about making amends, they went out and they did it. If you recall in our literature, it talks of Dr. Bob's first day. And he got home late that night. And Bill, who was staying at his home, asked him why he was late. He said he had been driving around Akron, Ohio, in his old Buick, mending fences. It's an old Vermont expression. He was making amends the very first day that he began to stop drinking. And I don't think we need wait so long in our program to do all the things that are required of us, especially so since we are told by the book that if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past or wish to shut the door upon it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience will benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. And I have enough experience to tell you that these are not extravagant promises. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes slowly, sometimes quickly. They will always materialize if we work for them. And by this time, they knew that what had been given to them was something very precious. And so they resolved to maintain it. And they knew that they could not afford the luxury of a resentment. They knew they could not be resentful or hateful. That if they were, they would drink, and if they drank, they would surely die. And so they continued to take personal inventory. And when they were wrong, they promptly admitted it. And so great, so real, and so true was their reliance upon a power greater than their own that they resolved to improve their conscious contact with God. They did that by prayer and by meditation. They meditated. They gave thought to their condition. They considered who they were and what they were. And they engaged in a very fine, a very excellent form of meditation. It is the form of meditation in which you are now engaged. They listened. They listened on the odd chance that this power that they had come to believe in would speak to them. And this power that they had come to believe in did speak to them in their groups, at their meetings. And they prayed, brothers, they prayed. When they prayed only for the knowledge of God's will for them and the power to carry that out. I don't know how it was with you, but it always seemed to me from a very, very young age, I had a feeling that I did not belong. I knew that I was in the wrong family. I knew that I did not belong with that bunch. I did not belong in the schools that I went to. I did not belong after I got out of school. And the remarkable thing about my case, I think, is that this feeling, which was very, very strong in me, persisted even though I was successful. I got along fine. Everywhere I was very successful. I was very successful in school. I was very successful at work. But I spent a lifetime on the outside looking in. And then I came to you and I learned to pray. And the 12 and 12 in its chapter on prayer, in the very last paragraph, says, and this is not a quote, but it's close, that perhaps one of the greatest benefits of meditation and prayer is the sense of belonging that comes to us. We are no longer alone or lost or frightened or purposeless. That despite all of the evidence in the world around us, we understand that the real values of life are truth and justice and love. And that we know that a loving God watches over us and that we turn to Him, all will be well with us here and hereafter. And I'm able to report to you that that sense of belonging has come to me. It isn't so much that I'm given the privilege of speaking at this meeting. The truth of the matter is, I belong here. I am supposed to be here. It's okay for me to be here because I'm a member. I belong here. And that feeling is great. That's a wonderful feeling for me. And a new feeling, too, and it's been with me for many years. A little later, they came upon a prayer they thought might help them. And you and I have prayed that prayer together this evening. And this time they prayed for themselves. But the only thing they asked was peace of mind. And so they prayed that God would grant them the serenity to accept the things they could not change. And they did change. Something happened to these people. Something happens to every man and woman who comes here and puts this program into their lives, and puts their lives into this program. There was a great difference between being drunk and being sober. And this difference they termed a spiritual awakening. And they had this spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And these were the men and the women who at the beginning of this process had admitted that they were helpless and hopeless and powerless. These were the ones who had no power. But having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, they found that they held in their hands and in their hearts and in this program one of the greatest sources of power that the world has ever seen. They actually had the power to arrest the disease of alcoholism. They had the power to save life. And the only thing they were using was the great power of example of one drunk for another. And armed with that power and having had that kind of a spiritual awakening, they began to carry the message to the alcoholic. And they did that so well that you and I have come together on a night in June in 1989 in the city of Oakland in the great state of California. And that, my dear, dear brothers, is a long, long way from Akron, Ohio. They knew what my sponsor knew. They knew that what had been given to them was a great deal more than simply a device to keep them from drinking. They knew that what had been handed to them as a free gift was an entirely new way of living. And to enjoy that new way of life, they resolved that they would practice principles in all their affairs. So where I had been, as I always was, very dishonest, they tried not to be so. When they had been, as I always was, very arrogant, they tried not to be so arrogant. Happily for me, and perhaps for us all, they said that we were not saints, that this is not a program of spiritual perfection. It is a program of spiritual progress. And my sponsor has instructed me, and so I believe that I can progress in the program if I don't drink and I go to the meetings. I could keep you for the rest of the year just to tell you, as the book instructs us, what life has been since. But I would not keep you that long. Please be assured that if you have a good wish for me, and I am sure that you do, everything that you might wish for me has already happened in my life. Every single thing that the disease of alcoholism took from me, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has returned to me in ways which are so mysterious and marvelous that I have long since despaired of trying to understand them. And just to indicate to you where the O'Keefes are at this moment, I bring you the warm and the fraternal greetings of six of my children who are members of Alcoholics Anonymous. That youngest one is very nervous, I'll tell you. I would be, of course, remiss if I didn't thank Clam and Alex and the committee, or whoever the hell it was that had the good judgment to bring me all this way. I am, as you suspect, one of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous who gets to travel, and I say the same thing everywhere I go, so if you've heard this thing before, you're hearing it again. And I end by talking about a pamphlet that is very dear to me, called The Member's View of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that pamphlet, the author takes a biblical turn at the very end of it. And he recalls a time when John the Baptist was once again languishing in one of Herod's prisons. And John sent two of his friends to inquire of his cousin Jesus as to whether or not he was the Messiah. And so these two men found the Lord, and they walked with him a while. And one day they stopped him, and they said to him, "Are you the Messiah? Are you the one that we have been waiting for? Or should we wait for another?" And the Lord really did not answer that question. But he said to these two men, "Go back to John and tell him only what you have seen and only what you have heard. Tell John that the blind see and the lame walk. And tell John that the deaf can hear and the sick are made well. And tell John that the poor have the gospel brought to them." In my early training, I was told that the word poor in that context could mean poor in spirit. And so, we all know that the word gospel simply means good news. My brothers in Oakland, in very happy convention assembled, if you will accept a report from me based upon my years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I will tell you only what I have seen and only what I have heard. And based upon that observation, it seems to me that the blind do see, and the lame do walk, and I know that the deaf can hear, and most certainly, the sick are made well. And I have seen over and over and over again into the longest day and through the darkest night the good news of this program brought to the alcoholic who suffers, the poor in spirit. God bless you.